Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome. Thank you all for being here. I'm Rachel Richardson, and I am delighted to be introducing this conversation between poets Brenda Hillman and Jeffrey G. O'Brien. I have the pleasure of introducing many of the Book Festival's poetry events and organizing them. And last fall, I set out to ask both Brenda and Jeffrey to be involved because they both had new books coming out, and I knew we'd want to hear from each of them. But the serendipity of this panel came in the idea that they wanted to talk to each other. At that time, I hadn't yet read their books, so of course I said, yes, great, but I had no real sense of why that was an interesting idea or what that conversation would generate. Now I've read the books, and I do, and soon you will too. First, a little professional background on our speakers. Brenda Hillman has published 9 collections of poetry, won the LA Times Book Prize and the Griffin International Poetry Prize, and is a professor of poetry in the MFA program at St. Mary's College of California. She's also an activist for social, economic, and environmental justice. Jeffrey G. O'Brien is the author of 5 books of poetry, as well as some collaborative works. He is a professor at UC Berkeley and has taught for many years as well in San Quentin State Prison for the Prison University Project. In their conversation today, these two poets will be talking about their new books, Extra Hidden Life Among the Days, and Experience in Groups. I read these two back to back, and it seems to me that they're already in conversation in many ways. Brenda notes that Jeffrey was a first reader of her book, which lets us in on a lovely collegial connection between them first. But the concerns of both of the books are highly relevant to our political and social moment as well. Brenda Hillman writes early in her book that friends ask the question, "What are you working on now that the elements are finished?" With that comment, she's referring to her last 4 books, which dealt with the 4 earthly elements and constituted a huge poetic undertaking. But there's also a good-humored hint of the apocalyptic here. The elements are finished. Gone. What are we to do? What is there left to say? Her book then proceeds to explore exactly that question of how to live in our present when we have to protest and endure obscene wealth inequality and environmental collapse, and when some of the most important people in our lives, those who gave us the strength to manage such devastations, have died. This book reads as both a testament to endurance and stubborn hope, often in the form of protest, and a keening love song for her lost friends, particularly her dear friend and fellow poet, C.D. Wright, her father, and spiritual forebears Rosa Luxemburg, Rosa Parks, and others. One of the recurring images in these poems is the understory, those things that grow in the muck of destruction, ferns, lichen, bacteria. The resilience of these forms of life is a comfort and provides a fresh way for us to see our present, not just as a depressing, unwinnable political struggle or a desolate landscape missing those people we loved most, but just as one part of life. There's much more happening among the days, pushing its own life forward, recreating by decay and decomposition. Experience in Groups also considers our collective in its many facets. Jeffrey G. O'Brien begins the book by meditating on glass and its arrogant trick of appearing not to exist while creating a boundary. It's a small subject, a close look at just one material, but his insights and frustrations bloom in the book into larger discomforts with our political and social landscape. He later talks about England as the wrong words in the right order, an imaginary language with real poems in it. That's amusing in its slipperiness, and if you're catching the allusions he's making to Samuel Taylor Coleridge and Marianne Moore, it's also a conversation with the past, shifting meanings as time shifts our centers of power and unrest. The argument between the singular and the collective twists through these poems, as does the mapping of borders and boundaries. O'Brien's work in prisons seems to inform many of these poems, often in sly ways, by looking at freedom and constriction, what walls do in dividing us, what freedom actually means, and how to mark both our separation and connection to others. At one moment, in the beautiful sonnet sequence at the center of this book, O'Brien poses the question, how did I end up in the present tense? And later declares, world without and. I walked it on the seam of push and pull, darkening that single idea. Farther on in the book, he says, the problem with pronouns is you says more and less than wanted, frequently all the time. Living goes on to resemble its cure. Both of these poets are thinking through what it is to live here, now, and what it is to engage with our troubled, troublesome, luminous, dying, regenerating world, and what it is to engage with language to tell about it. I'm going to step aside now so we can hear some of their poems and the conversation they'd like to continue with each other. They'll leave time for our questions at the end. And now, please welcome Brenda Hillman and Jeffrey G. O'Brien.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I'm going to start, and we decided a little bit on a format, and then we'll probably modify it a bit as we go along, and hope that Rachel will chime in with questions, and you all will chime in with questions. And I just heard an amazing panel with Esta Spalding and Tay Keller talking about children's books, and remembered what a great great event the Bay Area Book Festival is, so thank you all for attending. And I hope there's not too much overlap. I just read at Berkeley on Tuesday, so maybe you might hear a couple of the same ones. But we thought we'd each read about 10 minutes and then talk a little bit and talk to each other and talk to you. So this is the one of the poems early in my book that Rachel refers to, and it is an ekphrastic haibun, and a haibun is a form of poetry that has a prose block with verse lines that interrupt the prose block, and it's an ekphrastic haibun addressed to Robert Frost and to everyone else. Whose woods these are, we think. When they ask, what are you working on now that the elements are finished? I say the elements are never finished. In China, they have metal. In India, they have ether. In the West, we are short on time. Wood has also been named as an element. In white Euro fairy tales, children are sent into the woods, probably the Black Forest, carrying baskets covered with cloth made by child laborers just as factories are beginning. When I first read the Frost Snowy Woods piece as a desert child in the 60s, I experienced a calm as he enters the whose woods these are he thinks he knows, though I didn't know that many woods in Tucson, or a little horse thinking it queer, or a village. What would it have been like to be sent out with a small covered basket if you were a peasant child into what we now call the ecotone, the region between two environments, a marsh with striped frogs, for example, then on into the woods where a peasant uprising is being planned? We have sent them all into the woods, we have sent them all into the woods, we have sent them all into the woods, and we know exactly whose thin, logged out woods these are. What do people need from poetry during the changes? The changes are immeasurable. Perception, form, and material locked into the invisible. Many need calm poetry, especially at weddings where they feel uneasy, and I would certainly write that way if I believed calm were key to any of it. But if what woods are left are lovely, dark, deep, they are also oblique, obscure, magical, owned for profit, full of fragile, unnamed species, scarce on time, time that barely exists, so people base their lives on imagining it does. I hope to find some wisdom to send back to you, and that is what I'm working on now, my present, hopeful, wild, and unknown friends. This first section is maybe about environmental and personal grief that is explored in the rest of the book, and then kind of evolved evolved out of by the end of the book, or at least integrated into. Species prepare to exist after money. Turns out bacteria communicate in color. They warn each other in teal or celadon, and humans assign meaning to this, saying they are distressed or full of longing. The wood rat makes a nest of H's. It hoards the seven tiny silences. Crows in the pine can count specific faces like writers who feel their art has been ignored. My father spent his life thinking about money, though he knew it causes most of this stupid violence, and he thought of me as a sensible person. You have the chemical for sensible, he said. There was no tragedy between us, unlike how poor Joyce wrote that his daughter turned away from the battered cabman's face, the world. I didn't turn away because I don't know where it is. It is all over. And when it seems pure nothingness has come to pass, I know another animal prepares itself, nationless, not sensible. Thinking of it helps a little bit. And I'll read this poem in honor of the young people who are, S.S. Spaulding was just referring to the march for our lives in D.C. and the activism of the young people, which gives us all hope. One thing that gives me hope is the idea that people would get rid of their guns. The family sells the family gun. I only held it once, but thought about it often, as you think about those times when your life had stood both loaded and unloaded. One brother knew of its existence, having seen it where it languished in the famed green storage unit from which it had been transferred to the bank box, but we never knew quite when. Information our father had and something he was squeamish about or proud of at the same time, the way Protestants are about genitals. We believed it was a Luger, maybe taken from a soldier in the war our father trained for, but didn't ever get to because he was wounded in the knee. Sustained is the word they used. Sustained a wound in infantry maneuvers before his men were mostly killed after D-Day. When his ashes in the desert grave were lying, we took the weapon from the bank box. I put it quickly in my handbag to get it past the teller. The holster was the smoothest leather, brown and heavy, the yawning L-shape of the Luger. Google says Georg Luger, designed in 1898. The holster smooth as the jackets of German soldiers in the movies. And what had they done to make the cowhide smooth like that? And what had they done to the cow? We thought of burying it in the desert, but if you Google burying a firearm, it changes to a search for buying a firearm. You can also look up how to load a semi-automatic weapon on YouTube, where a white man with thick hands and a wedding band shows you how to check for rounds in what order and tells you how to handle it with your dominant hand. We couldn't take it to the cops, even in my handbag, though Arizona is open carry, and you can take it anywhere in public, but the cops can shoot you if you take your gun to their station. One young Tucson cop named Matt agreed to come to us and check the magazine and said it was unloaded, looked upon us with excruciating mild pity, said this relic might be worth some money, and stroked it the way some boys do. I couldn't tell what the brothers were thinking. It felt like tragedy, but reversible. Our father's ghost stood like a tall working summer, like Hamlet's ghost appearing only in the day and good-naturedly telling people not to do the killing, but still trying to control the actions of the play. You can think about ghostly word weapons nonstop. Let's just take a shot at it. She was going great guns. He loved her, but couldn't quite pull the trigger. Better to bite the bullet. Kill an hour or two. And for some reason, maybe sorrow for our father's power, lack of power, I felt a twinge when my brother whisked the tiny heavy out of there. My life had stood a secret little hiddenly shameful semi-automatic firearm, and when at night our good day done, I guard my master's head. My younger brother sold it for $600 at a Tucson gun shop. one of those outfits where the master paces behind the counter, offering advice on collecting and is so proud of his stash. It was a Tuesday, I think, a Tuesday inside history where America is lost, and what should we do with the cash? And I'll read one more. So this is from the sequence that Rachel mentioned. I was kind of channeling Rosa Luxemburg and Rosa Parks and having this argument in myself after partly in relation to Occupy and Black Lives Matter and other things I'd been part of about pacifism and thinking about metaphor and also metaphor and lichen and a lot of different things. And I kept a day book for a whole month, and I wrote every day in my notebook. So this is day six, and then I look forward to hearing Jeffrey. In the aftermath of the overwhelm, we hope to stay awake. Oxalis tries to stay awake, living in the smalls. Friends, when you were low as children, what punctuation did you love? It tried to help you along as lichen reads the stone, as Rosa rides the bus, as Rosa rides the train. Microsoft doesn't want to pace the Polish Z in Garamond, and they say Bill Gates has 36 bedrooms. Rosa looking at the sky out of the jail cell, vision released. To humans suffer so far back beside, outside the drought, ruffle lichen spreads a tasty dark beneath a tree where lobes with a larger lobe and ceridica looking like ridges of cocaine when we were bored and didn't know oblivion is another thing Big Pharma owns. A simile besides. As a child, I thought I could love everyone, and now I can't. Can't love George Zimmerman, Darren Wilson, Netanyahu. Tech support tells me she hopes this app will give our family a newfound freedom, and I am a twin. The other voices are invisible. Algae and fungi twinned with lobes 6.2 millimeters wide and long cilia fairly common on bark in cortex. Tex K plus yellow, medulla PD K to escape the nothing. I love it when young poets read outside, bringing 20 styles of natural into line. My brother's train set had a clump of plastic lichen representing nature, a world that dreams beside as when a poet reads outside within a dappled afternoon, her voice like someone leaving Eden in a syntax of three smalls. No binaries, no false praise or bullshit.
Thank you, Brenda. Thank you all for coming, especially in the middle of a mandatory leisure moment called Saturday. And thank you, Rachel, for the introduction. I'm just going to read three poems. They're pretty lamentational. The first is called Quick Trip, and is about watching Ferguson unfold remotely. So it's about hapless solidarity, solidarity at a distance, and the pain of remote viewing. Quick Trip, as many of you will remember, was the name of that convenience store that was burning. But it's also how quickly you can open your computer and turn on live stream and be watching something happening at the same time somewhere else. Quick Trip. It was just a time of matter. That zone between running and stopping, bread of gas and twilight, where all speech is eloquent as the outlines of cars and stores. Always just twilight, hence speech always eloquent, caught between massing and dispersal. There, people possess the eloquence of eloquence, while we watching have our uselessness. I hear fall will come, but not for any of us. I hear it will be here, but not as we would have it. A burning tire, driverless reins that seem commanded because of such economy as is. All scenes are hunting scenes. There's no good way to be, we must not say so. Nothing to do but kick yourself down the service road, a forgotten lane, flat on the ground, or against a brick wall, slammed there, temporarily, rights draining, like a crowd gone quiet, so it is said. Poetry would have you believe that words are acronyms, while the state that acronyms are words. You can't yet be rescued from this earth. So the suburbs politely burn, and the ring road, the QTs. It will happen again means dark blue can't be outrun. A verdict known before it comes. I hear of it from as far as my lap. The book is called Experiencing Groups, and there are three poems in the book called that, a grouping of experiencing groups. One of the things that many poems in the book are thinking is a continuity between the private quotidian and the public life of acts and events, such that there doesn't have to be a binary antagonistic relationship between having a private self and private concerns and everything that's happening all the time, near and far. This poem is thinking about things as trivial as washing the dishes and things as non-trivial as the disaster of refugeeism across the world. Experiencing groups. Things are worse than they are. The earth returns, a usable world. All my cells are pages stamped. Half the time reach comes back with nothing, though everything touches everything else. The sun has gone out in the poem, in both senses of out, all senses of in, or hasn't yet come, has, too weakly to be felt on your back. Sunlight messaging the streets makes them look spread with quiet excuses for motion called place. One day hate rhymes with the next. Things stay together, the center can hold. We know a few reasons for this, through which the ones we don't escape. But be calm as small green plums in the fridge at the end of August. If only one's left, be easy instead. Each feeling departs the time in which it lasts for another point on the graph, the next chest in the world. You are a host of the temporary, taking the short view of a long century already ending, leaving, left behind. The difference between escape and departure, the difference between command and instruction, between description and praise, praise and ascent, ascent and complicity, complicity and fold, fold and seam, seam and border, border and line, line and detention at a border, detention and camp, camp and asylum, asylum and detention at a border, detention at a border and rest, rest and care. Care and worry. Is fog become rain when it hits the pines? Dramatic irony. Not knowing things, but not knowing the things you do. And they aren't things, but a time, the jail of the year. What can be done? The dishes somehow are clean. That struggle is over. You can leave the kitchen entirely without guilt, flick, turn, or pull down the light. It's been one of those lives in a day, repeating vague portions of the new, to make time right, but it isn't, filled with objects at the end of the aisle of a stair. So the little collisions experienced as progress through, but it isn't, it won't, so be patient. As the future, things not even yet in the ground, be ground, though not the one we having are. This other experience in groups closes the book, and it was written 3 days after Trump was elected. and everything looked the same and a little bit different when you walked through the spaces we're used to walking through. The only thing I'll tell you about how the poem behaves is that throughout the book there are places where syntax gets disturbed so that the words aren't in the right order. Call it syntactivism. And that happens here several times, starting with the first line. So if you can't understand it, it's because it's out of the syntax of the understandable. Experience in groups. What is language is a new needed for the going on part of the end. You can tell has made it here because the air is with condition. The outside seems to be like anything placed in a lab or a subway car. The truths are showing through. The people have chosen to be. Each moves along fresh tracks on the erasable surface toward a tiny destiny, wearing in and out. It's maybe 3 days after, or exactly during seeing the future put on those certainties, I want of the opposite to speak, to say what isn't etymology won't be money to the king above my eye. Reach out to the invisible third among every two pedestrians, where belonging bucks its norms and difference can live in least places, shine caught in the multiple lie of any kind of hair. You can't tell if it's order or not to follow the too many paths just above the face, below sky, long enough to forget or be distracted from the big geographies where truth first learned of us, in the pit of an education, in the sky-sick life of power, in its moving rearrangements. I was walking on Mission Street, in love with you while damage bloomed. The right order, right in the words. Below the preserved fade of marquees, the little sail of needless things, listing bodies syntaxed past. It was far too easy to get here, standing still while white time flowed around its professional mourners, comfortable in end after end. The next one isn't very pretty. At least we'll see how together. It provides absent alternatives. My plan to put my body between where it already was and is going. Thank you. So a conversation.
Do you want to ask us something? And then we'll ask each other.
Sure. Which would be a good one to start?
I'll start with the question that I put first here. So I'm interested in the role of allegiances and conversations with other poets that happens in both of your books. And in Brenda's, you actually write poems to people and about people, friends, who seem like sort of compatriots, bulwarks against the end or the coming of the apocalyptic in our time, against our era, against our political state. And Jeffrey, you have these references to other poems that are often turned in an interesting way in yours, but there are these echoes of other poets and other literary conversations. So I'm wondering if you might talk about that, and if you both want to discuss how you take part in a literary conversation and what this does for your work.
So, one thing that maybe I can say of both of us is that we aren't afraid of having difficulty in our poetry. And by difficulty, I don't mean, you know, impenetrability, but modernist references. I always say to folks who ask about that particular thing that modernism is 104 years old at least, and if you start with Baudelaire, quite a bit older than that. But so I'm not afraid of reference or of writing art for other that assumes a kind of artistic context. That said, I think that I do want my poems to appeal whether you get the references or not. Like the Family Gun poem makes a reference to Emily Dickinson, My Life Had Stood a Loaded Gun, and maybe that reference came through you know, to you all, and maybe it didn't. And I think it adds something if you're having those literary conversations. Some of what I was doing in that poem was also trying something that Jeffrey and I had talked about, which was make a very rhythmic prose poem. So it has a lot of very iambic meters, and that was a sort of a, you know, sort of like, oh, Jeffrey might hear the iams, and I wasn't going to call him up or text him like, I'm writing a poem that might appeal to you because I'm writing secret iams in my poem. So you have those inside conversations with your friends, and then you also see yourself in the bigger literary context. I you know, somebody just asked me in the bathroom line over at the green room, like, what kind of poetry, or what's your topic, you know? So I had to characterize my poetry in one phrase while she was, like, heading to the bathroom line. And so you see yourself in a context of a literary moment, I think, that's always in conversation with literary tradition. And for me, it's very much a sort of feminist take on the eco-nature tradition of the West, and, you know, and that kind of thing too. So,
I will tack on to say that I think the title of Brenda's book is a great description of literary citation, as well as all the other things it means there about all the non-human life that we are unaware of or is below the threshold of perception. That citations, whether they're of the content of other poems or of the music of other poems, are there waiting for you, just like Whitman. Whether or not the poem functions without them, yes, of course it does. But it's a beautiful way to acknowledge the labor of the dead and the living, and decide that that group is always convenable and long and not lost. I would also say a paraphrase of that, which is that I think of poetry as a flawed but really useful technology for loving strangers, whether they're far or dead or near and simply anonymous faces you pass on the street. It's an asynchronous, disembodied technology for talking to strangers. And I think that the literary conversation that a poem is having with other coordinates of the past is one version of what it's also trying to do with anybody who picks it up. So to try and maybe move this slightly towards the political and activism, I'd also say that one of poetry's problems is that it's work that doesn't look like work, right? You could be sitting at a desk utterly sedentary or on a walk, and that's when poetry is invisibly happening, which means that its forms of intervention in the world are equally hard to measure or perceive. So sometimes the there of the poem, that Gertrude Stein is not there, just like Oakland, there's no there, has to happen through this material moment of making sounds, making music between and out of words that is keeping alive earlier forms of music.
To me, yeah, I didn't mean references in terms of sort of there being some secret key or something, right? Or like a certain kind of access to the poems. Or to me, these both references and just the fact that many of your poems are dedicated to people or show the conversations that you're having with other people, living and dead, those read like a generosity and a way of weaving poetry into the experience of the world as opposed to something that is removed from it. And it seems like that works particularly well with the subjects that you're talking about and, you know, being in the protest in front of the Apple Store on Black Friday or, you know, talking about what's happening in Ferguson and how it is to walk down the street right after the election. That these are a poetics of, a poetry of, and a there's a rigor, there's a poetics of engagement and involvement and a refusal to sort of separate out things, right? So on that note, maybe the next question is, in dealing with the subjects that you're dealing with, particularly protest and injustice, you're coming up against these powerful bureaucracies of government and corporations who use language in a very different way than the poet uses language, right? I mean, they use it to deceive, they use it to sell and to control, right, and to manipulate. So I always think of that as threatening to the aims of poetry. So I'm wondering how that worked for you in these books in terms of you're not ignoring them, you're not setting aside their presence, you're actually depicting the confrontation and the engagement of these with these powers. So I'm wondering how that enters your poetry, how you interact with the force, those kinds of forces when you're writing.
Forces of evil.
Sure, well, I mean, in the Quick Trip poem, I said that the state wants you to believe that acronyms are words, whereas poetry wants you to believe that words are acronyms. And I think, obviously, I believe that that second formulation is much richer and much less of an imposition upon anyone who receives language. I think of poetry as the place where we can encounter a relief from mercantilized language, militarized language, precisely because it's not only about dumping a particular and singular sense into us, right? It's not merely ideological. It cares about sound. I count syllables. So the chordal richness of trying to make sonic communications as opposed to only semantic communications, I think immediately puts most poetry at odds with the simple, digestible, and disposable language that comes at us in so many forms so often. It's not a protection, it's not a shield, but it's a reminder that there are other ways to speak to other people in full recognition of what language can do and of the self on the other side of that communication.
Yeah, that's great. And also, I just feel as if part of the poet's job is to reflect the language back to itself, no matter how uncomfortable it may make, you know, the culture. I was reading about, you know, we all get like 500 emails every day about, you know, with petitions, right? And so if you're following something, so I'm following the bees and the whole Monsanto business, and the chemical, you know, the chemical brand names that they use for, you know, the beekeeping, killing chemicals. And it's sort of like car names. And I think one of the things that poets, we're all very sensitized to language itself and to individual words and the diction, but just even the way that the diction is torqued toward prettiness if you're trying to be sold something. So I printed out from beecharmers.org the neonicotinoids, which is the you know, the chemical that they're using to try to kill the, you know, the little the pests on the crops. The names are incredible: Actara, Platinum, Helix, Cruiser, Adage, Meridian, Centric, Flagship, Poncho, Titan, Clutch, Belay, Arena, Confidor, Merit, Admire, Legend, Provado, Encore, Gaucho, Premise, Assail, Intruder, Adjust, and Calypso. Those are the names of the insecticides used, you know, to just spray crops. And I mean, poets, you know, we sort of go into a, you know, a tizzy when you hear the language being misused. So I loved, I just, you know, adore in Jeffrey's new book how when he's taking syntax and the phrase and turning it on itself to make like the better version of itself so that you can say the sensible thing, even though it's the phrase is turned on its head to say the sensible thing, which isn't the normal thing. And so if you look at those words for insecticides and you just think like this is how it's being sold to us, poets have to ingest the badness of the language that's being done to the culture as part of our task. So that's one of it. But also, I just feel like imagination, no matter what, is what we're supposed to be doing, right?
I want to add on to that about Brenda's work. There are two things that happen in this book and have been happening for at least the last couple that seem like they are utterly opposed to each other, but in fact I don't think they are. When Brenda in a poem or when the poem encounters small life, hidden life among the days, whether it's lichen or a kind of bird or a kind of insect, the poem will pause long enough to give us the full Linnaean Latin classification, right? And that moment of pausing and relishing and abiding with that way of knowing the world, when you could instantly have just moved on to declare feeling or any of the other things that poems do, is a moment of relishing the sound of that language and also saying, I will allocate this time out of respect to creatureliness, right? As opposed to swiftly passing in a euphemistic way over the name of the insecticide, right? In which you don't hear necessarily all of the damage it's about to do. And the thing that's on the opposite side of like these stately Latin names is Brenda's commitment to representing the sounds of non-human life in language, whether it's the RRR of a seal or stranger bird and insect sounds that I'm not going to attempt to reproduce here because I'd embarrass myself. So making room in language for the written names of things and for those things' own sounds both feel utterly counter and deliberately counter to that impoverishment of language that happens in the official names and brands for things.
We, when we were talking about like what we might talk about, and one of the things I kept running up against in myself is like, you know, they ask you to come and talk about poetry and activism, and it's almost always a despair sets in because I think we're supposed to, by now, Trump's been here for a while, now we should have some strategies. But in fact, the feeling of melancholy and, you know, and despair that's always creeping at the edge of your poetic imagination doesn't go away. And so how are you coping with it? And one of the things that gives me immense hope, and this may just sound ridiculous, but 15 years ago when I started working with Code Pink, one of the things that saved me from like the Democrats was just going to Congress and thinking about the microbes. Like, here we are, I'm listening to this bullshit in this congressional hearing, and I asked them not to record it so I could say stuff like this. I listened to the incredible, ridiculous language, and I thought, you know, but there are microbes in the gut of that man that are just having their life, and they're just not, they're it's a whole other existence, and there's probably, you know, even lice from his kid that he hasn't dealt with, and, you know, all this sense of like other life that was there, or the mole under the Capitol lawn that was just doing its thing and eating. And it gave me an immense joy that is boundless, and it hasn't left me.
I will add to that that, first I'm going to feel that joy with you. Okay. That despair is obviously a bad state to be in for any length of time, and it's certainly terrible for political action. But lamentation, elegiac work in the poem, to me that's a fundamentally optimistic act, because it's at least attempting to share the state of possible despair with someone else. And the second things are shared, they're more evenly distributed and easier to carry. One of the things that happened to me when I was writing poetry in the Occupy moment was I realized that for a long time, I had, as I said earlier, thought of poetry as this technology for loving strangers. But what I hadn't realized is how much I needed poetry as a refuge, because I felt so much despair about how to love strangers in an embodied, real-time way. And although I never overestimated what Occupy could do, it was a moment in which there could be mutual aid and recognition and action with people you had never met before. And it completely re-energized and torqued how I wrote on the page, because I had a much more filled out sense of a host of strangers who cared and could be work alongside each other without knowing each other's names, because the name that mattered was the task at hand.
And I was thinking about your change of the name of the film is Experiences in Groups?
The book.
Book, yeah. Experiences in Groups, which Jeffrey changed to Experience in Groups, which makes it, you know, both fuller and more individually lyric at the same time, which I really love.
Yeah, the book that I steal the title from is by the British psychoanalyst Wilfred Bion. And he's trying to think about how to make group therapy among soldiers after World War II. And so it's a way of trying to think of a group as being a productive therapeutic space where there has been trauma and not necessarily shared experience before the experience that the group itself is. And I wanted to take it from those discrete instances of experiences and make it more about all the kinds of experience that we have. Because one thing that I was accessing in that remote viewing poem about Ferguson that I think is necessary for thinking about activism in general and poetry in general too, is that so much of our experience now of the group is virtual, whether it's the petitions constantly flooding or the Twitterverse or anything like that. And to be in that virtual relation to any of the crucial questions of our moment can feel a lot like writing poetry, right? What kind of intervention is it to be in this bodiless relation to everything that's happening? So thinking the digital and the virtual as a space that, of course, can show us at our worst, but is also an incredible organizing tool, is also for me always a way of thinking about how poetry can produce effects that can't necessarily be easily measured, but are important despite their virtuality.
Well, I've alluded to some of the secret things that I love about Jeffrey's. They're incredible formal devices that I so admire. And one, Rachel alluded to the son. He has a sonnet sequence, Sonnet So Far, which is one long poem, but it's in 14 line stanzas, both discrete units of sonnet, but they also smear into each other. And I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about, it's just such a brilliant form that you came up with, if you'd talk a little bit about that.
I can, thank you. So the Elizabethan, the Shakespearean sonnet is really concerned with what we can preserve of people after their bodies go. And it's constantly self-congratulating about poetry's ability to preserve something of persons, even though the beauty of that person is going to wither as they age, and then eventually the body itself will be gone, and all that will be left is the black ink in which you shine bright, to quote Shakespeare. And yet sonnets also end in this incredibly conclusive way in that model, that couplet at the end of those three quatrains that sums up and seals the poem. And I was thinking about preservation of persons and that those hard closures at the moment when America decided to finally aggressively turn its attention to the murder by cop of people of color, even though, of course, this has been happening for 5 centuries. And I decided to write a poem that was going to, in real time, recognize these events as they continue to happen. And unfortunately, I had tremendous faith that they would continue to happen. And so what I wanted to do was make the sonnets into a kind of horrible death clock instead of this place of optimistic preservation. And I therefore also felt I had to puncture the ends of each sonnet and have them go on, sonnets so far, the ongoingness of this terrible cycle of police violence. And so instead of that hard closure of the traditional sonnet, they always go past that 14th line and then pull up short in the beginning of the next, and that happens again and again while they mention the names of the dead as they actually happened over the weeks and months in which I was writing it. I can turn it about.
It's a great form.
Yeah. Why are you in love with 12s?
Why am I in love with 12? So all poets have their secret OCD, you know, devices. And one of my... I started counting things. I think when my daughter, who's now 38, was little, I fell in love with the Count on Sesame Street. You know, remember the Count? The Count. But also, I think it tapped into the sense of orderliness that an anarchic, emotionally anarchic person might go to various devices for. You know, how do we make forms? How do we organize? And one of the things I thought, well, you know, I grew up with this, you know, this Christian right. tradition of 12-ness, and then there's the pagan part of 12-ness. So I did fall in love with the 12-line poem. How much can you do in 12 lines? Can you fit your whole worldview in 12 lines? Then I started doing two-word titles for several books. So everything that could fit in two-word titles, I would sort of snag that. And then I fell in love with six-word titles, and I'm still a little bit on six-word titles. It's just kind of a little magical thing that you give yourself. But 12-ness has this sort of awesome traditional thing that I think... Sometimes if you thrust an emotional chaos into a very tight form, sort of like the sonnet traditionally, but making up your own, yeah. Should we ask them something?
Sure, where are we in time?
Just about an hour.
So maybe the audience has some questions. We have like 15 minutes for questions.
Thank you. You're holding it. Here's my question. In the blurb for this event, it said it was about resistance in a time of ascending fascism. And I thought, fascism? Who uses that word? Interesting. So I came. But here's my question. Fascism hasn't been mentioned. The word is very, very fraught. And even more fraught now, I would say. And so I wondered if you would comment on that. And just to make my own views clear, I do think it is fascism, and we have to call it that. But I wondered what you thought.
So Jeffrey and I were both, this is part of why I didn't want it recorded, we've participated in various anti-fascist activities out in the street and everything. I'm an old grandmother. I cannot hop over walls the way I used to. I will be out in the street every time. I think that we almost take it for granted that we're supposed to put up with more and more and more and more, and things can get a little worse and worse, and we keep adapting, like, you know, crayfish being boiled alive. And I felt like the moment happened for me with the Iraq War, for the second Iraq War, not with the first Iraq War. I was sort of still asleep with kids with that. But honestly, when we invaded Iraq, that was kind of my moment where I can't tolerate anymore. And I think everybody in the room, everybody in the West, everybody in America is going to have their individual boiling point when they start calling it. I had big arguments with friends about whether we were in a fascist thing with George W. Bush. I felt like we kind of were already. But now it just seems like it's not even an argument.
Yeah, the hardcover of my book is these colors for a reason, but the colors of this hardcover aren't going to stop fascism, are they? I agree entirely with Brenda that there's a moment, and it's different for everyone, but I hope it comes for everyone, when you have to put your body in the streets and it's no longer about the decorous execution of language, right? Obviously, we have to oppose things within discourse, but there are some times when you have to oppose things with the visibility of your body, and you have to make visible that relationship to others who are bound by that task of opposing it. So I've been out in the streets and in the parks. I've had to shoulder past Nazis on campus at Berkeley again and again and again. The brazenness of this moment in terms of the width or range of, I don't even want to call them views, but they get treated with more respect than they should, so they do get called views, is astonishing. And the spaces that they've chosen to represent these views include Berkeley as a crucial target because of free speech, and I mean both the town and the university. And I don't think poetry is enough. I think poetry is a place where you can both report on what you do with your body, which Brenda does often, and it's also a place where you can espouse and what you should do with your body, and I want my poetry to do both those things, but at some point the book has to be closed and the bodies have to be out in the streets opposing what's happening. I frankly think that it's the white majority terrified of realizing at some point it will be a minority, and it's got a scorched earth policy it's attempting to enact in advance. But I'm not at all comforted by being able to decide why it's happening. And obviously that's not the only reason it is. But yeah, I would say that poetry solaces and re-energizes me for attempting to function as a body in the world as opposed to an armchair observer and recorder.
And that's, you know, that's certainly a task. By the way, we can't really see individual faces out there very well, but I see that you're in the back. For me, I have very weird metaphysical spirituality, and I turned to poetry originally for that. So now, you know, thinking of myself as an activist poet, it's not a complete overlap in what I feel poetry does, you know, in my life. And as Jeffrey's suggesting, it's only one of the things poetry does. Poets absolutely have to be writing poetry, doing street work or interventionist kind of actions in the street. That's something you don't necessarily feel you have to do. That's not going to necessarily keep you alive or something. That's an option in the minds of many writers. I don't think it should be an option as citizens. I think we have to figure out our ways of resistance that aren't comfortable. Yeah, and anyway, both these books are kind of full of the accounts of that. Are there other questions? Yes, next, yeah.
Hi, I'm wondering if empathy plays a role in beating back fascism at all, or if you see poetry as being a way of accessing empathy.
Well, I mean, I think that any good poetry understands that it doesn't know whom it's contacting, right? And it can't know that much about the person on the other side of the page, and therefore has to produce the richest and most open possible matrix of experience that it can. To some extent, that's something like empathy without knowledge, right? Knowing that you don't know about that person and still loving that stranger. So it's a strange category or paradox, which is empathy for that which you don't know at all, but know is there. When poetry models that, I think it's anti-fascist, even though, because it's not imposing its will and narrowing what can count as proper experience. But again, that's not an anti-fascism that's going to solve our material problems. But the world would be poorer without it.
Yeah, I agree with that answer. And I was thinking this morning, listening to, there was on NPR, there was, I don't know if anybody heard it, but there was a Baptist minister that was, it was talking about the changes in his congregation and how he was trying to adapt his own politics to the fact that he was just having to present, you know, points of view that he didn't think that his congregation was going to agree with, and he just kept saying, you know, Jesus, Martin Luther King, I mean, you know, go back to the messages of love, and they go with the necessary economic changes that we have to see. It's not that complicated. As far as empathy, I was working on a book called Practical Water, which was in this series of books about the elements, and I showed a poem, one of the Congress poems, to my husband Bob Haas, and he said, you know, yes, I was working in a mode that I wasn't comfortable with it. They were very reportorial poems. They weren't meditative, or they were just sort of straight reports and narrative. And I hadn't been working with narrative very much. And he just said, I think this is good, but I don't, the view of the Congress people is so monochromatic. You don't show any empathy for them. And I said, I don't feel any empathy. I hate them. And he said, but you have to, at some moment, you know, it's sort of like thinking about the microbes, which was my way. I couldn't really love them, but I could love the non-human. So my way of sort of trying to start loving the people, like the thugs, is to sort of think about their gut microbes. I'm trying to get there. I'm not there yet. But what I did with the Congress poems was, like, I started thinking, like, they probably have kids that are sick. I shouldn't hate them. I should think about, like, there's a mom at home or something like that. Like, I can imagine past my binary state. It helped me a little bit. But I'm a long way from that. From it.
Love the non-human and then move on to the inhuman.
Yeah, I think so.
We have one more question back here. Are you ready for the next question?
Hi, did you still have your question? I'll ask for
you. My question is probably similar to the last question. I was interested, Jeffrey, in your concept of poetry as a technology for loving strangers. And you talked a bit about it already, but maybe you could elaborate a little more about ways that we might manifest that. How can we use poetry as a way to connect with strangers?
Yeah, I mean, when I was talking about Occupy earlier, I was saying that a group can cohere in which something like love is passing among those who don't know each other in order to see out a particular task, right? To occupy a building, to feed the hungry, etc. And I think that the poetic equivalent of that is meeting on and in the task of reading the poem and feeling empathy flow in both directions, right? The poem which in its complexity and open-endedness respects it as a field for active engagement by a reader, but also the reader's empathy to lend him, her, or themselves to this record of existence and its written down form, which if it's musical includes something of that composer's body, right, and sense of what rhythm is and what how that can happen via words. So I think that they are analogous without being confusable for each other, the kind of empathic relation to strangers when engaged in material action and what's happening on the page. But I think that the poem is a good training ground for practicing that kind of love in more pragmatic ways off page. I think it starts by granting full interiority to others that you can take out with you into the world rather than seeing people as surfaces and an obstacle course to get past at evening commute.
Yeah, I love that answer. You know, I was thinking as I was driving over here that poetry, I really think poetry makes us better people, like, period. I think poetry, it makes us better people. I'm not sure that doing political activism has made me a better person. I think it's made me way less tolerant. Like, you know, I'm trying to recover from some of the stuff. I'm going to go on doing it, but I feel like it's I've had a setback to adolescence or something. But I love that answer about love, but also having been with Jeffrey at in a very crucial moment of Occupy when the cops were throwing out the tent city on campus, and there was a lot of violence, and Bob got, you know, hit in the ribs, and Jeffrey got really hurt very badly, and I saw Jeffrey like just stand there and not fight back, and I thought, you know, I'm not sure I'm that big a person. I think I have like too violent a temper. If I got really hurt and if I see my students beaten again, I think I might take like my backpack and just commit a felony. So I feel like I'm not sure political activism makes us better, but I'm positive that poetry makes us better, and I'm positive that love makes us better. But we still have to be actors because there's too much horrible stuff.
I just want to add quickly about that moment on Berkeley campus. I got baton speared by a cop while trying to protect a student, and I went down to the ground out of breath and with a small fracture in my rib. And I remember lying on the ground and thinking, how I get up will determine the rest of my political life. I can be terrified forever, or I cannot be. And suddenly there were like 15, 16 hands lifting me up, 19-year-olds, 25-year-olds, 70-year-olds lifting me up. And I was like, oh, it's not a private decision how I'll act. It's a communal decision.
I still might use my backpack next. Old grandmother goes to jail using her back.
About poetry being good for you. I mean, to me, it's about corruption. That you get to terrible political situations through the corruption of every element of life. And there's something about poetry. It's pretty hard to see a great poem that is corrupt in some way. It's like it's a way of fighting everything that corrupts us. I mean, George Orwell talked a lot about this sort of thing, but that's how I see it. That's why poetry means so much to me, I think.
Thank you.
As Brenda said, poetry often reflects our language use back at us, right? So it's certainly no stranger to documenting the corruption of the language of the tribe, but it doesn't participate in it.
I think we're about out of time, but thank you all for coming, and thanks to Rachel, and I love Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. Thanks, Brenda. Thanks, Jeffrey. If you would like to buy a book or talk further with the poets, you can find them directly outside signing.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.